Persigo Press presents the Henry Rios Mysteries podcast. Hello, this is Michael Nava, author of a series of crime novels featuring Henry Rios, a gay Mexican-American criminal defense lawyer, and the producer of this podcast. Today we present Lay Your Sleeping Head, the first novel in the series. Lay Your Sleeping Head opens in the summer of 1982 in the fictional town of Linden, California, 30 miles south of San Francisco. Linden is the home of the prestigious university of the same name, founded in the 19th century by railroad tycoon Grover Linden. Henry Rios is a public defender, born and raised in a small town in California's Central Valley and from a working-class Mexican-American family. He is a graduate of Linden University and its top-ranked law school. In 1982, there is no internet. People smoke in bars and on airplanes. Most gay men are closeted, and no one has heard of AIDS. It's an America where 83% of the people identify as white, 85% as Christian, and 83% say that homosexuality is morally wrong. Ronald Wilson Reagan, who once declared that trees cause more pollution than automobiles, is the president of the United States. In this episode, Rios has an unexpected encounter with Hugh Paris's mother.
Hello?
Henry, it's Grant. I did some digging and you were right.
About what?
Pretty much everything. Christina's entire estate went to Nick. About $250 million. The judge got himself appointed Nick's conservator.
Wow. Without the finding of simultaneous death, half of that would have gone to Jeremy's estate and then to Hugh. $125 million.
There's more. Even without Christina's money, Jeremy's left an estate of a couple of million that should have gone to Hugh. But Hugh is a minor, so the judge got himself appointed executor of Jeremy's estate, put that money in trust, and became the trustee.
And what happened to that money?
Well, the trust was supposed to dissolve when Hugh turned 21, but the judge filed papers claiming Hugh was a drug addict and incapable of managing his affairs, and got the trust extended indefinitely.
That must have been the trust Hugh said he was entitled to the first time he talked to me about the judge withholding money that belonged to him. What else?
You were right about the inquest. It was conducted by a municipal court commissioner who later got himself elected judge. Guess who was his biggest contributor?
Bob Paris.
He contributed $250,000 to the campaign. But the guy only spent $50 to get elected.
What happened to the rest?
The commissioner kept it.
That can't be legal.
It's perfectly legal. Under state law, unspent campaign contributions don't have to be returned.
So it was a two-part bribe. Money and position.
Exactly. What did you find out from your old prof about the hypo in his casebook? Was he talking about Christina Paris?
Yes. Huh. She, Professor Howard, and the judge were involved in some kind of romantic triangle 40 years ago, and she made the wrong choice. Professor Howard drafted her will and was helping her get out of the marriage when she was killed. He said what finally drove her to divorce was that something had happened after Hugh came to live with them, but she never told Howard what it was.
You think it was the sexual abuse?
Timeline fits. Hugh never knew his grandmother was trying to protect them. There's someone at the door. I'll call you back, okay?
Sure. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Coming. Mrs. Paris.
Hello, Mr. Rios. May I come in?
Sure. This is a surprise.
I came to apologize. Your apartment? Orange crate bookshelves? The Indian print over the sofa? That Picasso poster? It reminds me of my freshman dorm room. Well, except that there aren't overflowing ashtrays and a bong.
This is my freshman dorm room. Transported to every place I've lived since.
Are you quite sure you're gay?
I'm sure. Please, sit down. May I get you something to drink?
No, thank you, but may I smoke?
Of course. Now, there's an ashtray somewhere in the kitchen. Let me find it for you. I searched the cupboards for an ashtray, couldn't find one, and returned with a saucer to a cup that disappeared a long time ago. She was perched at the edge of the armchair with the leaves of grass opened on her lap and the cigarette burning between her fingers. I set the saucer down on the table in front of her.
The book was opened to the Calamus poems.
I was going to read them to Hugh.
This one? Or, if you will, thrusting me beneath your clothing where I may feel the throbs of your heart, or rest upon your hip. Carry me when you go forth over land or sea, for thus merely touching you is enough, is best. And thus touching you would I silently sleep and be carried eternally. There's so much yearning in that poem. It's almost too intimate, too hard to read. You really loved my son.
Yes.
After you left yesterday, I got this letter from Hugh, forwarded from Boston. He writes about you. He says, I know I can't stay clean for anyone by myself, but he makes me believe I'm worth it. He makes me think I'm not so broken that I can't love, that love can't heal me. I know you're skeptical, you should be. It's been one false start after another, but Mom, this time, with Henry's help, I believe I can turn my life around, stay clean, and become the man I was supposed to be. When you meet him, you'll see why I love him. You and his father are the only people Hugh ever told me he loved. After I read the letter, I regretted how I had treated you when you came to see me, and I wanted to make an amends. So, here I am. What do you want to tell me about my son's death?
Before I do, can you tell me about Hugh and his father and you? There's so much I don't know.
The thing you need to know is that there's a long history of mental illness in the Linden family. Schizophrenia, to be precise. Grover Linden's son was schizophrenic, and his daughter also showed signs of it in her later life. Then it skipped a generation to Nick.
Hugh was worried he might have inherited it.
Hugh had many problems, but I don't think he was mentally ill. His demons were external.
Tell me about Nick Paris.
Nick and I were kindred spirits. We both came from wealthy, proper families. His was wealthier, mine was more proper. Money and propriety, they were the straitjackets we couldn't wait to escape. We met in college in the early 60s. Harvard for him, Radcliffe for me. I went to a mixer, and there he was, handsome and wild-eyed. He took me into the garden, and we emptied his flask and talked about art and love and poetry. After that, we carried on as if we were the second coming of Scott and Zelda Fitzgerald. Eventually, we dropped out of school, eloped, and moved back here to San Francisco, just as the beatniks were leaving and the hippies were arriving. Bliss it was in that dawn to be alive, and to be young was very heaven.
Wordsworth?
Very good, yes. Wordsworth, writing at the dawn of the French Revolution, another revolution that failed. Hugh was born, and our little family was complete, and for some time it was bliss, heightened, of course, by chemicals and lubricated by drink. And then Nick got sick. When the madness first struck him, it was like watching a gorgeous bird suddenly fall from the sky, crawl around on the ground. You knew something was broken. But the wings were intact, the plumage still dazzling, and the song was the same. And for a while, the bird manages to fly again, maybe shorter distances and not so high, but it's still flight.
And then he falls again and can't fly at all.
It was some time before I understood how sick he was. You have to understand, our friends were artists and eccentrics. crazy was a compliment in our circles. So when Nick started behaving oddly, I thought it temperament. But then he began to experience delusions and hallucinations. I finally got him to a psychiatrist who diagnosed his schizophrenia. I thought it was the worst day of my life. I was wrong. Nick refused traditional treatment. He believed he could cure himself by expanding his consciousness, because he believed his illness was simply a figment of his ego. We went to ashrams in India where he fasted and meditated for days, to curanderos in Mexico who drove away the evil spirits with drums and rattles, to a psychiatric commune in England where patients smeared their shit on the walls and were dosed with LSD. The delusions, the hallucinations, the paranoia only got worse.
You told me his father thought the family was under a curse.
Ah, yes. The Linden curse. That's what finally led to his institutionalization.
What is the Linden curse?
It's money, of course. The fortune. Nick was deeply conflicted about his family's wealth. He felt undeserving of it, but he couldn't bring himself to renounce it either. He told me once he felt like an animal in a trap whose only escape was to gnaw off its limb.
You said he was terrified of anyone Chinese. How did that figure into his illness?
As he got sicker, Nick became obsessed with how his great-grandfather had made his money. Somewhere in his research, he discovered that the Chinese workers Grover Linden imported to build his railroads were treated like animals, and that hundreds of them were killed in accidents. The story haunted him and turned into a delusion. He began to believe that the angry spirits of these workers, led by someone he called the Warlock, were pursuing Linden's descendants and seeking vengeance. He believed the Warlock was going to send people to abduct Hugh and sacrifice him to atone for Grover Linden's crimes against their ancestors, thus the terror of Chinese people.
Is that why he had Hugh tattooed?
The peach is an ancient Chinese symbol to ward off evil spirits. Nick had Hugh tattooed without telling me. I was furious. It was one thing for me to deal with Nick's delusions, but I didn't want him scaring Hugh with them.
Hugh seemed to adore his father.
It was mutual. After Hugh was born, Nick seemed to improve, as if the love he felt for Hugh left no room for the disease. Hugh was too young to understand Nick was ill. All he experienced was Nick's devotion. And then Nick tried to kill him.
What? Hugh never said anything about that.
No, he didn't remember. And when I told him, he called me a liar. Nick's delusions about the Chinese warlock got tangled up with the story of Abraham and Isaac. You know it?
God commanded Abraham to sacrifice his only son as a test of his faith, but then, at the last moment, stopped him and sent a ram in Isaac's place. What did that have to do with the curse? You said Nick was trying to save Hugh from being sacrificed.
Schizophrenic delusions grow and change in the schizophrenic's mind. Nick got it into his head if he showed he was willing to sacrifice Hugh. Then, as in the biblical story, the warlock would intervene at the last moment, save Hugh, and lift the curse. One night in a hotel suite in Paris, he drugged Hugh, built a kind of altar surrounded by flowers and candles and incense, and placed Hugh on top of it. I came home to find Nick kneeling at the altar, holding a knife above his head, aimed at Hugh's heart, and chanting in some made-up language. I attacked him and got the knife, though not until he had managed to stab me a couple of times. I grabbed Hugh and ran out into the corridor, screaming for help. Nick was subdued and sent to a hospital. Hugh never knew what happened.
How old was Hugh?
4, I think, maybe 5.
What happened to Nick?
The doctors put him on Haldol. It stopped the delusions, but he said it left him feeling like a ghost. So he would stop taking it, and the delusions would return. One afternoon, when we were back in San Francisco, he walked into a restaurant in Chinatown where he thought he had tracked down the warlock. He was carrying a loaded pistol to kill him with. Fortunately, some police officers happened to be having lunch there and overpowered him before he could do any harm.
Was he prosecuted?
The great-grandson of Grover Lyndon prosecuted? No. Calls were made, checks were written, and Nick was committed to the asylum in Napa, where he's been ever since. Where he will die.
I'm sorry. I can't imagine what it must have been like to lose your husband that way.
Oh, the marriage was over long before that. I dealt with Nick's illness by drinking. By the time he was committed, I was a hopeless drunk, and I was as much a danger to Hugh as Nick was. Robert Paris threatened to take me to court and have me declared an unfit parent unless I let Hugh go live with him and Christina. I agreed. He gave me some papers to sign that he said were necessary for him to make decisions about Hugh's care without having to track me down and get my consent. Only later, after I got sober, did I realize I had signed away my parental rights. I tried hiring a lawyer to regain custody of Hugh, but no one would touch the case, not against Bob Paris, and not with what he had against me.
What was that?
Adultery, alcoholism, drugs, and more than one suicide attempt. Even after I got sober, no judge would have entrusted me with Hugh. Bob refused to even allow me to see my son. After that, the fight went out of me. So, yes, you could say that at that point, I abandoned Hugh.
Did you explain this to Hugh?
Mr. Rios, when your child asks you, why did you leave me? It's not a question. It's a shriek. No answer will ever satisfy him. After he dropped out of college, he'd show up at my place in Boston when he needed money or a break from killing himself with heroin. We'd have a good day or two. Then he'd start up with accusations and we'd get dragged back into the circle of rage and guilt that never resolved anything. And I'd throw him out. He blamed me for his addiction. I told him that belonged to him.
Do you believe that?
I'm a drunk. A sober drunk, but still a drunk. And there is one thing I am very clear about. You don't get to blame your drinking or using on someone else. No one else but you puts the drink in your hand or the needle in your arm. That's your choice. No one else can put them down for you. That's your choice, too.
Addiction is a loss of control.
No, it's a compulsion. But even in that compulsion, there is an element of choice and the possibility of stopping. I'm not saying it's easy or that most addicts can simply decide one day to stop on their own. I was fortunate enough to have stumbled into AA at a moment when I had finally had enough and was ready to do anything to stop. I prayed that that moment would someday arrive for Hugh. This letter, it seems like that day had arrived. He says he was clean. Is that true?
He had one relapse after he went to see his father. Other than that, yes, he had been clean since his last rehab.
He went to see Nick? He shouldn't have gone, not without me. Nick is as good as dead.
That's what Hugh said, too. It was terrible for him.
You said one relapse, but they found him dead with a needle in his arm. What happened to my son the night he died if it wasn't a self-induced overdose?
I'd been with him earlier that day in the city. Then I came home. He was having dinner with a man he'd known in prep school, Grant Hancock. Then he drove here. On his way, he was rear-ended by someone who I believe was following him. When he pulled over to exchange information, the driver, or another man who was with him, grabbed Hugh, restrained him, and drove him to the campus where they injected him with the lethal overdose and left him to die.
Oh my God! Who did this?
All the signs point to your ex-father-in-law.
Bob? Why? Is this about the sexual abuse?
You knew about that?
It was one of the things Hugh blamed me for.
Did you believe him?
I don't know. I didn't want to because it only added to my guilt. But Hugh never spared me the details, and they sounded convincing. Still, if Hugh planned to accuse Bob publicly, Bob would have fought back, not killed him. He would have enjoyed the chance to humiliate Hugh as a homosexual drug addict and a blackmailer.
Hugh thought he had something else on the judge, even more serious. He believed the judge had arranged for the car accident that killed Christina and Jeremy Perez because she was going to divorce him.
Those are simply old rumors.
Actually, Hugh had uncovered evidence that implicates the judge, and my own investigation had developed additional evidence. Not enough for a conviction, maybe, but definitely enough for the police to reopen the matter. Tell me, do you think your ex-father-in-law is capable of murder?
Bob Perez is a sociopath. Does that answer your question? What does any of this have to do with what you suggested when you came to see me? A second autopsy?
The medical examiner who conducted the autopsy ruled Hugh's death an accidental overdose. But both I and the police detective I'm working with saw injuries on Hugh's body that pointed toward homicide. We think a second independent autopsy would confirm that and force the police to take another look at the circumstances of Hugh's death. I know, it's a lot to ask.
It is. All right, I'll agree to it. What do you need me to do?
Have you buried Hugh yet?
His body is in a mortuary in the city. I was going to fly him to Boston next weekend to bury him with my family. I can't stand the idea of him being anywhere near the Lindens.
There's a pathologist in the city I've used for other cases. Will you authorize the mortuary to release Hugh's body to him?
Yes. Give me his name and I'll call the mortuary this afternoon. I'm willing to help you. But you'll understand if I can't. Thank you.
I understand.
Goodbye, Mr. Rios. You know, Nick was right. We are cursed.
Here's the file you requested. I'm sorry it took so long to find it. There's not much call for photographs of 19th century Chinese railroad workers. In fact, I can only remember one other person who asked for them many years ago. He said he was a member of the Linden family. But his name wasn't Linden. It was... what was it?
Nicholas Paris?
Paris, yes. That was it. I remember because he created a disturbance and I had to ask him to leave.
What kind of disturbance?
As he looked at the photographs, he began to weep. Quietly at first, but then quite loud sobbing. Do you know him?
I knew his son. The men in these photos, they're all so young. This one in the straw hat looks like a teenager.
The newspapers called them Linden's monkeys and predicted they would be useless because of their stature and supposed effeminacy. But they organized themselves into family associations and proved to be tireless and disciplined workers. Of course, that didn't prevent Grover Linden from paying them half of what he paid white workers.
Seriously?
It was called the Chinaman's Wage. And when the workers went on strike, Grover Linden starved them into submission.
Was one of them your ancestor? Is that why you know all this?
I'm Japanese, not Chinese.
I'm sorry,
No need to apologize. I won't make the obvious joke about all of us looking alike to Westerners. I would be proud to have one of these men as my ancestor.
I understand they died by the hundreds building the railroad.
They were given the most dangerous jobs precisely because their lives were thought to be less valuable than the white workers.
What's going on in this photo? It looks like he's being lowered in a basket down a cliff.
That's how the railroad blasted through the Sierras. A man in a basket setting dynamite charges in a mountainside. The trick was to reel them up before the explosion. A lot of men died that way. Many others in avalanches.
And left there?
Well, no, actually. In Chinese culture, it is essential to be buried with your ancestors so you can be venerated along with them by your descendants. After the railroad was built, the bodies of those who had died were exhumed and sent back to China. Contemporary accounts claim that 20,000 pounds of bones made that journey.
10 tons of human remains.
Yes. That was the human cost of the Transcontinental Railroad.
This wasn't mentioned in my fourth grade California history textbook.
Was it called The Pageant of California History?
How did you know?
I read the same text in a classroom in Manzanar.
Manzanar? Why do I know that name?
It was where my family was interned during World War II. Of course, I'm older than you are, so you probably had a revised text, one that left out the Chinese railroad workers and Manzanar.
Yes. And the only thing it said about my ancestors was that California was briefly a part of Mexico, but fortunately, the Americans took it over. Well, as the saying goes, history is written by the winners.
History, perhaps. But history isn't always the truth. And the truth is like a weed that pokes through the cracks in the sidewalk. It finds a way of surviving, even if only in some old photographs in an archive somewhere, waiting for the right person to find it. Do you want anything else?
No. Thank you.
All right, then. I'll leave you to it. No tears, all right?
I sat there shuffling through the photographs, as haunted by the eyes of the young men in them as Nick Perez must have been when he saw them and came up with the idea of sacrificing his son to atone for the sins of his great-grandfather. He had failed, but maybe the sacrifice had been completed when the cops found Hugh with the fatal needle jammed into his arm.
You've been listening to Lay Your Sleeping Head, a Henry Rios mystery. If you enjoyed this podcast, please spread the word on social media. We depend upon your support to keep this series going. For updates and behind-the-scene extras, visit us at our Facebook page, The Henry Rios Mysteries, or at michaelnavawriter.com under the podcast tab. We'd also love to hear from you. Message us on Facebook or email us at persigopress@gmail.com. That's persigopress@gmail.com. This is an abridged version of the novel, Lay Your Sleeping Head. You can buy the complete novel at Amazon. For this episode, our cast was Armando Rey as Henry Rios, Douglas Georgas as Grant Hancock, Scarlett Hepworth as Catherine Paris, and Judith Nihe as the archivist. Our director is Russell Kaltschmidt. Our sound engineer is Dave Peck. Music and sound effects were composed by Josh DeRosa. The episode was written and produced by Michael Nava. Thank you for listening.